It is Wednesday, August 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the city of Charlottesville, Virginia, remembers the woman killed after a white supremacist march this past weekend. I talk with a presidential scholar about President Donald Trump's assertion that both sides were responsible for the violence.
The general reaction across the political spectrum yesterday was one of shock.
Talks on NAFTA begin in Washington, and the Arctic's epic mosquito swarms may get worse with climate change. It's all ahead. A memorial service was held Wednesday for the woman killed over the weekend when a man drove his car through a crowd of people counter-protesting a white supremacist rally in the city of Charlottesville, Virginia. 32-year-old Charlottesville resident Heather Heyer was one of hundreds of activists who amassed Saturday in the city to protest a demonstration by white supremacists. She was killed when she was struck by a car driven by James Alex Field Jr., a Nazi sympathizer who allegedly deliberately steered the car into the crowd. Heyer's father, Mark, spoke about his daughter at the service.
She loved people. She wanted equality. And in this issue of the day of her passing, she wanted to put down hate. And for my part, we just need to stop all this stuff and just forgive each other. I think that's what the Lord would want us to do, is to stop, just love one another.
Heyer's mother, Susan Breaux, also addressed the memorial.
And I think the reason that what happened to Heather has struck a chord is because we know that what she did is achievable. We don't all have to die. We don't all have to sacrifice our lives. They tried to kill my child to shut her up. Well, guess what? You just magnified her.
On Tuesday, President Donald Trump went back to blaming both sides for the deadly racial violence in Charlottesville after Monday's statement in which he condemned the neo-Nazis and white supremacists, but made no mention of counter-protesters. Trump appeared to lose his patience, accusing what he called the alt-left of charging the far-right marchers, violently attacking the other group with clubs. He said the counter-protesters had no permit to be there. Trump also said George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were slave owners and wondered if their statues need to be taken down too. I spoke with Nicole Hemmer, assistant professor at the Miller Center at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. I asked her if Trump's comments further isolates him from the Republican Party and from the country as a whole.
I believe so. I mean, I think that the general reaction across the political spectrum yesterday was one of shock, that a president would say essentially that the people who oppose white nationalists are just as bad as white nationalists themselves. That's a pretty shocking thing to say, and to be unable to differentiate between people who led an armed rebellion against the United States and the people who founded it. I think for a lot of people, it just suggested that he's not temperamentally or perhaps even experientially fit to be president.
And also, why support for the far right? Is that such an important part of his constituency?
Well, it's certainly been something we've seen throughout his campaign and now his presidency, is a real reluctance to distance himself from these groups. Other presidents who have unwanted support from groups like these have been very firm in their denunciations of the ideas that groups like the KKK and white nationalists stand for. And so Trump's reluctance has been notable. And whether it's because he sees these groups as key to his support or because he just doesn't like being told what to do, which he's constantly being told to denounce these groups, I don't know his motivation, but certainly he is comfortable enough with their support that he's unwilling to come out strongly against it.
Mr. Trump has been criticized by members of his own party, including just today Senator Lindsey Graham, who said that Trump's words are dividing Americans as opposed to, not healing them. Mr. Trump's also been criticized by Orrin Hatch, as well as Marco Rubio, radio. Considering these are coming from members of Mr. Trump's own party, again, he seems like he is really further isolating himself.
Well, the question is what the cost will be for him, because it should be fairly easy for politicians to come out and denounce neo-Nazis and people who support neo-Nazis. That should be a fairly easy task. But what we've seen over the course of Trump's campaign and his presidency is that Republicans can sometimes bring themselves to criticize the president, but they haven't really withheld support for his agenda. It's not until we see those kinds of consequences that will know that he's truly politically isolated.
Now, you live and work in Charlottesville, and I believe you observed some of the violence over the weekend, over on Saturday. What was that like?
It was incredibly shocking, actually. I mean, I think we knew that there was going to be some violence. The white nationalist who came to Charlottesville came looking for a fight. But by the time that I arrived downtown around 11 a.m., so about an hour before the rally was supposed to start, the violence was already at a pretty high level. And then seeing such visceral things like white nationalists setting upon a young black man with sticks and beating him in front of the police and there not being any intervention, and then seeing the aftermath of the car ramming attack, they're the kinds of things that you see on television but rarely see in real life. So it was a stunning thing to see.
And at this time, there is a memorial service underway to honor Heather Heyer, who was the young woman that was killed in that. I'm sure this has had quite a deep impact on the city itself.
I think that's right. You know, Charlottesville, I think, prides itself on being a center of progressivism in the middle of Virginia. And that's a complicated story, but having been the site of this kind of violence and to have someone who lives here lose their life to it, I think has really shaken the community, and it's left people wondering, you know, what do we need to do to stop something like this from happening again? Because there is a real worry that they'll be back.
Nicole Hemmer, assistant professor at the Miller Center at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, not only is Heather Heyer trending on social media, but so is her mother, Susan Breaux. And we heard a bit of what she said at that memorial service just at the top of the show. That one quote, a letter a lot of people are sharing, they tried to kill her and shut her up, but you didn't do that. You magnified her. Very powerful words. Susan Breaux also encouraging people to use their energy to find good in the world, to stop hatred and evil from spreading, and encouraging people to not let her daughter's death be in vain, saying that this should be an inspiration to go out and try to stop hate. So social media calling this speech powerful, inspiring, and heartbreaking, wondering how does she have the strength to not only speak and get up there right days after her daughter has died, but to speak so eloquently. So lots of praise for Susan Breaux getting up there and being able to do that. There are also reports circulating on social media that Susan Breaux had reached out to thank President Trump for denouncing the violence. Some of those reports using fake tweets, so a bit of fake information spreading around this incident. But many people, again, focused on her words and what she had to say. There's also a lot of focus, not just south of Washington, D.C. in Charlottesville, but just north of us up in Baltimore, where in the middle of the night last night, a number of Confederate statues were removed from that city. Lots of those pictures circulating on social media as people were tipped off to that. The idea here appears to be that city officials in Baltimore wanted to avoid any incidents like there were in Charlottesville, any kind of back and forth with protesters. So they just removed these statues in the middle of the night. But those images, kind of haunting images, that you see these statues just being lit by one spotlight or streetlights being lifted up by cranes and put it on the flatbeds of trucks. And that's being well cataloged on social media. And as much as we're talking about what's going on in the present day here in the U.S. and these social issues, there's a lot of people talking today about something that happened 40 years ago today. August 16th, 1977 was the day that the king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley, died at the age of 42. So 40 years later, people remembering his life and music, sharing a lot of clips from his movies and songs. Lots of images from Graceland. I know I've been down to Graceland in Memphis, Tennessee. It's a bit of a tourist trap, but it's something, it's a cultural touchstone kind of for Americans. And very interestingly, a lot of people using Elvis's music, the fans of his music, to kind of cope with the troubles and tribulations that are going on today, saying that they want to find something familiar that they can enjoy and not have to think about what's going on in the world in the midst of all these terrible things. So they're turning to Elvis Presley on this day to celebrate him and what he's meant to them.
Yeah, I happened to have been in Memphis, actually, on that day. And it was quite dramatic. My family were living there at the time.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yes,
I can only imagine.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The Kenyan opposition will contest the presidential election in court. President Trump says North Korea's Kim Jong-un is wise to postpone a missile launch towards Guam. President Trump criticizes business leaders as more leave his manufacturing council. And Indonesia's president vows to protect religious diversity. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scottish researchers say they've found evidence that the world's largest volcanic region may be laying beneath the thick ice of the West Antarctic. The research revealed 91 previously unknown volcanoes that range from 100 to about 3,850 meters in height. Scientists acknowledge East Africa's volcanic ridge is currently the densest concentration of volcanoes in the world. But researchers from the University of Edinburgh say they found many similarities in the collection of volcanoes in what is called the West Antarctic Rift System. Analyzing measurements from ice-penetrating radar, the researchers were able to look beneath the ice sheet for hidden volcanic basalt rock, similar to previously discovered volcanoes in the region, whose tips can be seen above the ice. The researchers also compared their findings to other geological measurements as well as with various database records. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new report on Arctic mosquitoes. Negotiators from the United States, Canada, and Mexico are meeting in Washington Wednesday for their first round of talks on renegotiating the 23-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement, also known as NAFTA. The talks were a key campaign pledge by President Trump, who's criticized the Free Trade Pact for enlarging the U.S. trade deficit and wiping out millions of manufacturing jobs. He had threatened to pull out of NAFTA. Mexico's economy minister, Ildefonso Guajardo Villarreal, met with Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland on the eve of the talks and expressed the hope of productive meetings and a good outcome.
We are here to work for a very constructive process. That's what we are here.
Exactly.
It helps that we have been involved in trade matters for a long time, including with the trilateral meetings. We're going to be holding bilateral meetings between Canada and Mexico, Mexico, the U.S., U.S. and Canada. And this is a common practice every time there is a plurilateral type of discussion. I have always said that a negotiator cannot be an optimistic. It has to be a realistic with a positive approach.
U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, speaking on a conference call with reporters, said the sides would begin to merge proposed texts during this first round and indicated he expects an ambitious start. Gary Huffbauer, an economist with the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the talks will involve two broad categories. The one most likely to cause little controversy will be modernizing or updating NAFTA.
These will be subjects like state-owned enterprises, perhaps digital commerce, e-commerce, perhaps labor and environment, maybe a couple of other subjects. Then, in the second category, it will be big differences. So the U.S. will make suggestions, which I think the Canadians and Mexicans will not be very warm to. For example, provisions to require a country, one of the three countries, which has a bilateral surplus with the others, to reduce its surplus. That would be Mexico, with the United States especially. maybe a provision to get rid of the arbitration mechanism to review anti-dumping and countervailing duty cases. Maybe something on government procurement where the United States wants to be able to pursue Buy America policies, which are actually in contradiction of the existing NAFTA text.
The president during the election campaign last year had promised to renegotiate NAFTA largely because of the large U.S. trade deficit with the two trading partners and the loss of millions of manufacturing jobs. Can those be brought back?
Well, no. Most economists don't think that's possible. But obviously the president does, and he's the president. In fact, the United States does not have a trade deficit with Canada if you include services. Now, the president always talks about merchandise, you know, stuff you can touch and feel, especially manufactured goods. But if you include services, the United States actually has a small surplus with Canada, and Canada will emphasize that important point. With Mexico, it's a different story. Yes, the United States has a $60 billion annual trade deficit with Mexico.
Well, there are concerns that renegotiation could impact, for instance, the U.S. auto industry and American farmers. Obviously, the U.S. negotiating position has to be very carefully thought out.
Because the U.S. negotiators promise that they will do no harm. So what that means is that if they're doing anything which causes Mexico or Canada to limit, for example, U.S. agricultural exports, which are quite substantial to both countries, that would be harm. And that would be harm to red states. So that's a line they don't want to cross. The president thinks that possibly more autos could be made or more auto parts could be made in the United States, but that would mean fewer made in Canada and Mexico. And the auto industry is now actually has peaked out on sales, and they're falling a little bit now. So it's really not a great time to be talking about moving auto production from Mexico or Canada to the United States. So this will be tough terrain.
Gary Huffbauer of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He said he expects the negotiations to become contentious with the potential that one or more of the parties will threaten to pull out. In the end, however, Huffbauer expects a new agreement to emerge sometime next year that won't please everyone, but could result in greater liberalization in areas like government procurement and services like education and health. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. The Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet. Across the tundra, the rapid changes are affecting creatures large and small. That includes the ferocious Arctic mosquito and the caribou it torments. It's a snapshot of how climate change is rippling through entire ecosystems around the world. VOA Steve Barragona reports.
Summer in Greenland. Life makes the most of this short season of long days before the harsh winter returns. Caribou graze, flowers bloom, and mosquitoes swarm by the millions.
It can be quite miserable.
Dartmouth College ecologist Lauren Culler studies the web of life in these Arctic ponds. She says each year as the ice melts, a battle for survival begins between the larvae of mosquitoes and of beetles.
There are just thousands of mosquitoes within sight, and then you'll see these beetles come through and just grab one, and then they feed like spiders feed. They inject these digestive enzymes first, and they liquefy the internal contents of the prey and suck it back up.
The mosquitoes that escape that fate emerge from the water and go looking for caribou or other animals to bite. The caribou face so many mosquitoes that they flee from their grazing grounds, losing precious time to fatten up for the winter. Culler thought climate change might give the beetles an edge and cut down on the mosquito hordes.
In warmer conditions, the beetles actually consume more mosquito larvae per day. So one of the things we looked at was, is it that more mosquitoes are being eaten in a warmer year, so fewer are likely to emerge? That was kind of what we thought would happen.
It did not. In warmer water, mosquitoes matured a few days faster.
That's 3 or 4 fewer days where you have the potential risk of being eaten by one of those predaceous diving beetles. And in the simulations that we did, we found that that actually really matters and that the mosquitoes win in that situation.
When mosquitoes win, caribou may lose. Fewer may survive the winter. But the tundra holds more enemies for mosquitoes than just beetles.
We're also investigating how the spiders might play a role in controlling mosquito emergence, because they seem to be able to cue in on the ponds right when the mosquitoes are emerging.
Locked up in ice for much of the year, tundra ecosystems are simpler than those in warmer climates. Untangling the web of connections here offers a taste of the complex ways climate change is altering the rest of the planet. Steve Barragona, VOA News, outside Kangerlussuaq, Greenland.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It seems that President Bashar al-Assad's voracious prison network has swallowed and silenced another individual whose peaceful views were an affront to the Syrian regime. Noura Ghazi Safati, the wife of one of Syria's most renowned advocates for democracy and free expression, Basel Haqtabi Safadi, announced August 1st that she had been informed that her husband was executed in October 2015, days after he was taken to an unknown location from Adra prison. This is a loss for Syria. This is a loss for Palestine. This is my loss, Noura Ghazi Safadi wrote in a Facebook post. 34 years old at the time of his death, Mr. Haqtabi was of Syrian and Palestinian descent. A vocal advocate for freedom of expression and access to the internet, Mr. Haqtabi was the founder of IQ Lab in Damascus in 2010, an online community of open-source information and programs that brought together engineers and democracy campaigners and helped make the internet accessible to the Syrian people. After peaceful pro-democratic protests broke out in 2011, initiating the Syrian Revolution, Mr. Haqtabi's work helped keep activists informed and connected. He was arrested in 2012. After his arrest, and amid credible rumors of his being tortured, many international human rights monitors, as well as the United Nations, condemned his detention and called for his immediate release. The United States labeled him a prisoner of conscience. But the Assad regime would not release Basel Haqtabi Safadi any more than the tens of thousands of other innocent civilians they have imprisoned since the uprising began, an imprisonment characterized, as U.S. State Department officials have noted, by suffocating, overcrowding, beatings, electrocutions, rapes, and, as in his own case, secret executions. In a statement, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said the United States deplored his execution and extended heartfelt condolences to his family, friends, and loved ones. The United States is outraged, she said, over the repeated acts of brutality, including torture and extrajudicial executions conducted by the Syrian regime. The Assad regime bears responsibility for the widespread suffering, death, and destruction it has inflicted on its own citizens. Every day, courageous individuals work to recover from the devastation that the Syrian regime has wrought, and the United States will continue to stand with them as Syrians work towards a negotiated political settlement that brings an end to the conflict.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.